Do you like music or do you like technology? Or do you like talking to people? CGSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CGSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show and tons more. To find out more information, visit cgsf.ca.
An adventure is coming. Fun Drive 2025 is just around the corner. Your support is important so we can continue to rise higher and reach further to bring you the local and community radio that you love.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
We're living in a world of overwhelming uncertainties that threaten to sweep away our innate ability to maintain our inner peace, which allows life to flourish. This inner peace, as expressed by love, exists as goodness itself and is the strongest alternative to helplessness, resentment, hate, insanity, bitterness, and crazy violence. The human capacity for compassionate love lies within us. None of the relentless offers of human enhancement, such as Botox or anabolic steroids, and the dubious promises of the fountain of youth, adds to a deeper inner peace. Today, we'll focus our attention on the capacity for a generous love that embraces such virtues as kindness, courage, forgiveness, gratitude, dignity for all, and hope, with our guest, Dr. Stephen G. Post. Stephen Post is an author, speaker, and one of the world's leading scholars in altruism, love, compassion, and the science of giving. He's the director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Compassionate Care at Stony Brook University's Renaissance School of Medicine. Also, he's the founder and president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, a nonprofit organization advancing the scientific study of unselfish love and positive psychology. His many books include Why Good Things Happen to Good People and Pure Unlimited Love, Science and the Seven Paths to Inner Peace. So please join us for the next hour as we explore the scientific research and spiritual insight of compassionate action with our guest, Dr. Stephen G. Post. I'm speaking with Stephen at his home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Stephen, welcome today.
Well, I'm so happy to see you again.
It's my treat as well. I'm so glad that we have you returning. And in, of course, with this very, very poignant and needed subject right now. I want to start with going back to your own calling, how you found your calling, and going back to your early life. And I know that early on, as in high school, you were mentoring grade school students, and you were really enlivened by that. And then later on, just before you entered college that summer, you were offered an opportunity to mentor some inner city kids in the Bronx, and your father objected and said, no, you're going to go work in a lampshade factory this summer. And Stephen, this led you to what I would describe as a Jack climbing the beanstalk moment in your life, that you decided you're not going to work in this factory. And so describe what happened and how, where that led you.
Well, I had a dream when I was 15. I was studying a lot of world religions up in New Hampshire at a place called St. Paul's School. It was an Episcopal outfit, but very ecumenical. And I was not a hockey player. I loved to cherish the natural world around me. It was so beautiful. I would walk around peripatetically, reading scriptures from Hinduism and Buddhism and Judaism and Christianity. And people thought I was a little unusual, but they liked me and they accepted me and no one gave me a hard time. When I was 15, I woke up one morning, not really fully woken up, but kind of betwixt and between. And lo and behold, I saw a road in front of me, and it was absolutely covered with cloud and fog. I couldn't see far along it, but I knew it was going to the west. And I looked to my left on this road, and I saw the face of a young guy who was had dirty blonde hair, and he was about to jump. And then a beautiful angelic face came into the dream and said to me, and I'll never forget this, "If you save him, you too shall live." And that meant a lot to me at the time. I didn't had no idea what it exactly meant, but I felt that somehow I was called to do something that maybe was in the West. At that time, I was teaching a lot of French-Canadian kids in a grade school across from St. Paul's on Pleasant Street. And I loved that. And I knew from the get-go that I was destined to be a teacher. And I've been a teacher all of my life in different capacities. And I was going to go to Swarthmore. And my that summer, I had a wonderful job opportunity in the Bronx, but my dad, he wasn't a bad man, but my dad just didn't think it was safe. And my mother especially didn't think it was safe. So after a lot of bickering and pretty heavy arguing, my mother said, "We're not going to cover you for college." And I said, "Mom, that's pretty dramatic." And my father put his foot down. He'd been a naval commander in World War II, and he knew what he was saying. So I said, "All right, if I don't take this job, what am I going to do this summer?" And he was the president of Sloan's Furniture Store on Fifth Avenue. And he said, "I know what you can do. You can work at Bill DeBono's Lampshade Factory," which was in Patchogue, Long Island. So I did that for 2 weeks. I drove out to the factory. I worked between two large women, and they were perfectly nice. They smoked a lot. And I was responsible for cutting cardboard for the lampshades. And after a couple of weeks of this, I got so frustrated, and I knew I was so far away from my destiny, that I took my dad's, at the time, failing gray Mercedes 190, and I drove out to a beach town, West Hampton Beach, on the eastern end of Long Island, where I had some friends from school. And we hung around that night, And then I decided, you know, I'm going to drive this car as far west as I can. And I did that. That night about 11 o'clock, I just started going west on the Sunrise Highway, went through Manhattan for the first time, went over the George Washington Bridge. And there it was. There was a sign, and it said Route 80 West. And my dream had pointed me in the direction of the west. So I knew I was going west. And I got about halfway through Pennsylvania. And now it's about 4 in the morning. It's dark out. I don't have a phone. There were no cell phones back then. And lo and behold, the generator on this old Mercedes began to break. And that's a very serious thing. It means you're not going anyplace. I was just about, by the way, at that time, wanting to pull over and do a roundabout on the Midway and get back to New York, because I thought then my reputation would be unspoiled. But that was not what fate had in mind for me. So I was able to pull over to the right. The car was completely dead. There was no light. I didn't know what to do. So I pulled out a piece of paper from the glove compartment, and I wrote a note, which became notorious in my family for at least several years, to the Pennsylvania State Police. Please return this car to Henry A.V. Post, 44 Davison Lane East, West Islip, New York, 516-669-5655, from his son, Stephen, who no longer works in the lampshade factory. And then I thumbed a ride, and I got all the way out to Omaha. Well, I hitched. I put my thumb out, and I got a ride very quickly from a guy named Gary who had a truck, and he got me to Grant Park in Chicago. And then from there, I rode with a few hippies to out west on 80. And lo and behold, one of the young gals said to me, "You really should call your mom, tell her that you're alive." It was a thoughtful thing to do. And so I did. I got on the payphone, of course, and to collect. I said, "Mom, I'm in Nebraska." And she said, "Thank God you're alive. We thought you were dead. Now we can call off the Pinkertons." And I said, now this was really obnoxious. I said, "Mom, why did you call the Pinkertons? Didn't you get my note?" And I said, "Mom, you probably should have let me follow my calling, because I felt that I really wanted to do that in the Bronx, and you really should not have interrupted that. It wasn't worth it. Look at the situation now. Dad had to go all the way out to Pennsylvania and pick up the old Mercedes." So she said, "You know, we were probably wrong." And then she let me have the address of my cousin George Lamont, who was a former Green Beret living on Chenery Street in the Mission District. I spent the summer there. And
that's in San Francisco then.
San Francisco, yeah. It's an area of San Francisco. And I won't go into the details, but that's exactly how I got started. And I knew that somehow I was following the dream, because I was going up to Reed College in Portland, and I was hitchhiking. I'd gone through Golden Gate Park, and I was walking over the Golden Gate Bridge. I got to the middle, and it was so, you know, it gets so foggy. You can't see more than a few feet in front of you. And it's probably 8:30 in the morning. And I heard this scratching on the left over the little fencing. And it was this guy with dirty blonde hair looking like he was going to jump. And I said to him, I said, "I hope you're not planning to jump." And then he started cursing at me, because I was interrupting this very sacred moment for him. And I said, "Look, I think I've come all this way to meet you and to talk with you." And he just was apoplectic about this. But then eventually I said, "If you come over that fencing, I'm going to give you a present that will change your life." Now, that summer on Market Street and Chenery, I had been hanging out with the Nichiren Shosho Buddhists, the Nam-myo Renge Kyo people. And that just means, you know, I honor the divine in you, which is the Buddhist sense of resilience.
It's a chant that's pretty universal. Many, many, many people know that chant.
Yes, they do. Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. And so the last morning I was in San Francisco, I had gone to the temple, and they had given me this gohonzo, which is a scroll that they use in that tradition. And they said, keep this wherever you go, it will bring you luck. And so I had it in my backpack. And when I saw that fellow on the bridge, I looked over and I said, you know, if you step over to this bridge, to me, I'm going to give you something that's very special. I'm going to give you a gohonzo. He had no idea what that was. And I said, well, come over, I'll show it to you. And I opened it up and I looked at some of the symbols on it, like the heart with the line through it, which means no heart. You're too busy to really take the time to spend with people and communicate. And so we talked about it for a while. And he was very thrilled by this. And I said, look, here's my cousin's address, 16 Chenery Street. I'll give you some money. I had some dollars. I gave him some money for a bus. And then he took the bus, and I didn't see him again ever. But the next Thanksgiving, I was down in San Francisco, and I asked my cousin George, how's Harrison? And it turns out that Harrison had gone to North Carolina with my girlfriend from that summer, by the way, which is okay. And they were okay. They were fine. And he was well. And as far as I know, they're still alive and they're still living out somewhere near Durham. But that was amazing. And it was the fulfillment of a calling, of a destiny. And then the story goes on a little bit further, because when I was at Reed College, where Steve Jobs slept on my floor, by the way, he was there for about 6 months. I was in Ackerman Dormitory. So I'm in the coffee shop with Jobs and some other friends. And this guy comes just bursting through the door. And his name, I'm Andy. I've got a brand new Harley Davidson Shovelhauser. It's the fastest motorcycle in the world. Who wants to go for a ride? And I, in my immaturity, which I had plenty of and probably still do, thank heavens, makes up for my getting a little older. So I went out on the parking lot. It's about 11 o'clock. I'm sorry, it's about 9 o'clock. I jumped on his motorcycle, and he just took off. He hit 180 miles an hour. He went through all of Portland. It was wet. It doesn't snow in Portland, but it gets icy sometimes. So it was slip sliding along. And I said, please let me off. And he wouldn't do that. I was really feeling I was near death.
Well, so you were terrified.
I was absolutely horrified. And he was shrieking into the night with the cold rain across his face. And I said, please turn around. And he actually did a sweeping U-turn over the midway. And he dropped me back at Reed College in the little parking lot in front of the coffee house, just where he picked me up. And I staggered off that motorcycle, and I got across a little bridge to Ackerman. As soon as I crossed the threshold of the entrance to the common room, the payphone rang. Now, I never picked up the payphone, but I'd given my mom the number. And so she called, and I picked it up because I just felt pushed somehow in a way I can't explain quite rationally to pick up the phone. And she said, Stevie, you're alive. This is the second time she had to say that to me. She said, I just woke up and I was sweating and I thought I was dead. I thought you were dead. And I thought I couldn't leave this alone. I couldn't get back to sleep. So she called me and she said, thank God you're alive. And I said, Mom, I'm thanking God I'm alive too, because I didn't think I was. And we went on about that. And that's where I realized with my mother, who agreed with me, that somehow there is such a thing as non-local mind. Mm-hmm. That's the fifth chapter in this book. May you know the one mind, that somehow 3,000 miles away, across the entire country, she was aware and alert of my being imperiled and the level of my fear that night. Now notice, you know, it's 11 o'clock California time. It's 2 a.m. in New York. So beyond time and place, she had this incredible intuition. And if you look at the science, and there are some studies of this, a lot of times mothers do have these incredible premonitions about their children, and they're quite remarkable, which I won't go into because it would take too much time, but it's the power of love that brings that together.
Well, I know that you mentioned, and thank you, those are just riveting stories and great examples of like the one mind, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But I want to go back to your calling, and part of your calling, Stephen, has been deep listening. And you give an marvelous example of that when you were working with a young woman at, she was from Bayside in Queens, and she was going to quit medical school.
Yes.
And you even stopped in your tracks, and you had other appointments, but you spent 3 hours with her. And tell us that story.
So I'm sitting right here at my desk, and this is exactly where I was sitting when she knocked on this door, which is about 3 feet away from my desk. And she was obviously struggling and emotionally distressed. And she said, "I need to talk with you." And it was amazing because I had been on a committee, and she had been called in to talk to this committee about her academics. And we just met each other in the most unusual way, but she felt that she could trust me. So she found out where my office was, and she came in here, and I had plans for the whole day. I had people to see for, you know, every hour for the next 5 or 6 hours. And she seemed like she really was supposed to be with me that afternoon. And I really felt it wasn't quite like I felt at Reed College when I felt a kind of a subtle push toward the phone to pick it up when my mom was calling, but I just felt somehow that sense of push. And I've never seen anything. I've never hallucinated, but I looked over my right shoulder and I just felt this energy. And so I knew that was what really made me determined that I was changing my schedule. And I changed my schedule, and she became one of my mentees. She wrote a beautiful paper on compassionate care for difficult patients. She did take a year off and lived with her family, relatively poor family in Queens. And my wife and I would drive out there at least every month or two and take her out to a very nice restaurant, make sure she was doing well. And she kept writing beautiful reflective essays. And at the end of the year, she had a journal that was really publishable and beautiful. And she felt strengthened through that process. She came back to medical school. She did well. She did a residency. And now she's living in Connecticut. She's married to a very nice guy. And she's a practicing clinician. And she has a wonderful child.
Isn't that wonderful? And I just was so impressed that, you know, she did take the year off and she did take your advice to do some writing about it. And you didn't leave it there. You actually went and then read her writings and gave her, you continued to mentor her. And now, as you say, her life has just worked out. And I know in no small part because of your attention, your deep listening, your dedication to your own inner voice. And that takes us back to the one mind, which is one of the paths that you talk about. And so in that one mind, as you spoke about, like, it's non-local. So what is the one mind for you? What is your experience of the creative genius of the universe or God or whatever you call it?
Well, you know, I'm an Episcopalian, I suppose, by background, but I'm also very Hindu. And in fact, I was in India not too long ago at the Indian Institute for Advanced Studies, talking about consciousness, dementia, and the one mind, making the argument that people become demented, but that doesn't mean they're gone, they're a husk, they're empty, they're a shell. There can still be an awful lot there underneath this neurological deterioration, because mind is more than brain. That's a key point. I was at the U of Chicago for grad school, and I knew Sir John Eccles, who got the Nobel Prize. And he was very firm with me. He said, just because everybody thinks that they can reduce mind to matter, that you can get something like mind out of cells, tissue, an organ called the brain, don't believe it for a minute. And he never did. And he discovered everything you could discover, basically about the synaptic connections and the neurotransmitters that were involved. That was a long time ago, really quite a while ago, but he became very famous. But that was his view. So he did not think that you could get mind out of matter. On the contrary, he actually felt that you could get matter out of mind, which I think is pretty close to what Einstein believed when he talked about these things. So to me, the one mind means that we're much more connected than we think. We have these very deep, profound experiences of synchronicity. When I ran into that fellow on the Golden Gate Bridge who was about to jump, he looked an awful lot like the young guy I saw in my dream, who was also about to jump off some ledge that was otherwise unspecified. So for me, synchronicity is reality. And I've had so many experiences of synchronicity in my life. And I feel pretty strongly about that. I think it's the baseline of a lot of spirituality.
I'm thinking, Stephen, in the point of religion might be to have a direct experience of the creative source of the universe or something like that. But I know that you have quoted Gandhi, who mm-hmm. talked about how love is the cohesive force that binds humanity and leads us to peace and sustains the earth. And so love as glue. Let's talk about love. What is it that you refer to? Love is a difficult word to understand. It has so many meanings. So help us to understand how you view the idea of love.
Well, I, by the way, in terms of Gandhi, so the Hindu tradition, you have the original mind, if you will, the supreme mind, which exists before all else. And its characteristics are three things: freedom, creativity, and love. And our reason for existing is for those things to be expressed in our lives: love, creativity, and freedom. And so what is love? I mean, it's a term that's very abused, but I have a definition in the book that's very, very clear. And I picked it up when I was a PhD student in Chicago studying world religions with Mircea Eliade and all those great people.
Now, Stephen, before you give us this wonderful definition, I'm going to just say that to our listeners that we're here with Stephen G. Post. He is the author of Pure Unlimited Love, Science and the Seven Paths to Inner Peace. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to the website unlimitedloveinstitute.org or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by